Come in our studies of 1 Corinthians to chapter 7. And this really does follow on from the previous chapter in discussing the problem of immorality. But it also appears to be a subject on which the Corinthians had written to Paul and been asking him questions. And reading between the lines, it is possible that the Corinthians were saying, should we marry at all? If we are married, should we give up our wives? Or perhaps they were saying, look, I'm married to an unbeliever. Now, is that a valid marriage? Does God recognize marriages between believers and unbelievers? Should we divorce until they are converted? So it's against this kind of background that Paul is writing to them. Now, we've already looked a few weeks ago at the matter of God's will. Should I marry? What is God's will for me? Is it God's will that I should marry? And we have seen how so many Christians, myself included, have had great struggles with this and have been caused severe grief because of this, because we have got it wrong. Thinking that God has some kind of blueprint that we have to somehow discover and to follow. People have completely screwed up their lives, where the scriptures say that such an attitude is not one to be commended, but one to be condemned, because it is attempting divination. It is attempting to discover that which is in the future, which God has not revealed. And being in the future, God says that's not for you to know until it happens. We looked at Deuteronomy 29:29 on this matter. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but that which is revealed belongs to us and to our children forever, that we might do them. God reveals truth that we might do it. If God has not revealed anything, God has not revealed his will on a particular matter, then it's not for us to know. And so the question then of who should I marry, should I marry at all, is down to personal preference. And in fact, that is exactly what Paul tells us in this chapter. But we need to notice also something else. Paul speaks about the current distress. He talks about problems that are existing within the society to which he's writing. And so we have to consider that as a background as well. The implication is, he doesn't tell us exactly what it is, but he says the current distress. That implies that there was some degree of persecution of believers. And Paul would want to have them avoid the problems that come from being married and being in a time of persecution. Because, as you know from any book that you've read, or from any film that you've seen where this sort of thing happens, that the married man, especially the married man with children, is always threatened not with having his own head chopped off, but having the head of his wife or of his children chopped off. And he's told, if you don't do this, if you don't recant, if you don't do the thing we want you to do, then we will harm them. If you really love your wife, your husband, really love your children, then it's agonizing, tormenting of mind to be put into such a situation. If you're single, if you're unmarried, you don't have any children, you don't have that problem. They can't threaten anyone else and say, look, we'll do this to them. Big deal. Well, you might have some concern for them. But there's not the same emotional pull upon you. You have a greater freedom than you would do if you were married. So when Paul writes these things and seems to exalt singleness, celibacy, it is partly because of the problems in which the Corinthians were living. Now let's look first of all at verse 1. Concerning the things of which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, some people look at that and they say, well, that means that we should separate the men and the women, and we should have the men on one side, and we should have the women on the other side, And at the end, we should make sure that they don't, not just that they don't kiss, but they don't even hold hands or brush against one another. Well, you'll be pleased to know that is not what it actually says. What it actually says is it is good for a man not to be bound to a woman. He's talking about marriage. It's good for a man not to be bound to a woman, not to be married. However, right, we have a however, a nevertheless. And so immediately we see that this is not absolutely binding upon us. While it is good not to be bound in marriage, Paul says, nevertheless, while that's a good thing, we also have something else to consider. We are not dealing here with black and white. We are dealing with many, many shades of grey. And so therefore, we have to listen carefully to what Paul says. You get so many people and you still hear it being said in books, in newspapers, on the television and on the radio. People will trot out the line, of course, Paul was a misogynist. That is, Paul was a woman hater. Paul wanted nothing to do with women. Paul wanted nothing to do with sex. And so the whole Christian church is infected with this stupid idea of no sex, no women. And I always wish that I had the opportunity to talk to these people, especially if they're in the broadcast media, and to ask them on air, have you ever read all the passages of Paul's writings that are relevant to this? And they would have to admit, no, they hadn't, because otherwise they wouldn't make such stupid, idiotic comments. Those words are carefully chosen. They are stupid and they are idiotic, because it is the exact opposite of what Paul talks about, as we shall see. Paul, if he was a member of the Sanhedrin, which is possible but we can't be certain, if Paul was a member of the Sanhedrin, he had to have been married. And it seems to be the consensus of the commentators that Paul was at this time a widower. His wife had died. Because it's clear that here, as Paul's writing, he is single. He is not married. But if he was a member of the Sanhedrin, he must have been married. So his wife's either left him or she's died. And on the basis of what Paul has said, it's most likely that if he was married, she had died. But that is speculation. So Paul says it's good not to be bound to a woman because there are advantages. And he spells out those advantages in the course of the chapter. We'll look at some of them in future weeks, God willing. But there are advantages because of the immorality that's around. Helps you to avoid such things because of the problems of persecution. It helps you to avoid many of the problems that come with persecution. However, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife and each woman have her own husband. Paul is very well aware of temptation. Paul is very well aware of the power of temptation. And Paul is very well aware of the particular power of sexual temptation. And that's why he writes as he does. Because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. Much better. Although it's good that you're not married, it is better for you to be married rather than falling to the temptation of jumping in and out of every bed that becomes available to you. That would be far, far worse. And so, rather than getting into such a situation, therefore, be married. Let each man have his own wife and each woman have her own husband. But once you are married, are you to abstain from sex? And people would immediately come in and jump in to verse 5 and say, look, doesn't Paul say that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer? Abstain so that you can concentrate on prayer and fasting? Well, yes, he does. But what's the context in which he said this? Verse 4. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. That sounds like equality to me, and so often people say, Paul, was anti-woman. It looks like this is giving a woman a very high degree of authority over a man. It's mutual within marriage. And once a person is married, they have to recognize that they are now under different ownership. If they are a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, firstly, they belong to Christ. We've seen that in the previous chapter. But the second thing they have to recognize is the moment that they're married, not only do they belong to Christ, but they belong to their spouse. They belong to them. They are owned by their spouse. You no longer belong to yourself. You can no longer say, I want to do this and I want to do that. Suddenly there's someone else who has a say. And in the context, Paul is specifically talking about sexual relations. Now, this has immediate implications. You listen to the world, you watch the television, and the whole function of a man and a woman getting together, in the case of a man, is for the man to get pleasure. And from the woman's side, the whole purpose of a woman getting together with a man is for the woman to have pleasure. And so the whole emphasis is, this is how you can get pleasure. Paul says they've completely missed the point. You are not in a marriage situation and you are not in a marriage bed in order to get pleasure. That is not your purpose. Your purpose is to give pleasure to your spouse. You are to be entirely selfless in this matter. And you are to concentrate on the pleasure of the one whom you love. Now, of course, your spouse is the same. That they, while you are attempting to give them pleasure, are attempting to give you pleasure. And the greatest pleasure to be obtained from the union of a man and a woman is when they seek the other's pleasure. The world is ignorant of this. And therefore, the world keeps running after will-o'-the-wisps. The world keeps saying, this is how to do it, and they're wrong. Because they miss the point. In a marriage, the wife's body belongs to the husband. The husband's body belongs to the wife. So Paul there is encouraging sexual union between a man and a woman. Paul doesn't say it's wrong. Paul doesn't say you shouldn't do it. Paul encourages it. Verse 5, do not deprive one another. Except with consent for a time that you may give yourself to fasting and prayer. It's got to be mutual consent. If you abstain, mutual consent. And the purpose, fasting and prayer. And after that, come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Paul recognizes the great power of these feelings and the problems that can arise. And so therefore he says, the devil will tempt you. Every time that you find yourself in a situation where you are deprived of your spouse, there is a danger of you losing self-control. So therefore, do not deprive one another. Because there are needs to be met, and they are to be met within the context of the marriage. Paul says this is not a commandment, it's a concession. And the concession is not that you should get back together. He's talking about whether you should deprive one another or not. Whether you should fast and prayer. It's a concession because he understands the situation. I suspect that one of the reasons that you get dissatisfaction within marriage is because people don't read this passage and understand what it says. How often do you hear people saying, I'm getting divorced because my needs aren't being met? What they should be saying is, am I meeting the needs of my spouse? And if I am not meeting the needs of my spouse, then what's wrong with me? I should do something about it. A whole marriage relationship is not something dirty. It is not something disgusting. It is something glorious. And it is something beautiful. And just to prove this, in Ephesians chapter 5, Paul says these words, verse 22, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Saviour of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church, and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle, or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh and nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh and of his bones. For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband." Paul likens sexual union to the relationship between Christ and the church. How can it be evil? How can it be dirty? How can it be disgusting? It is a glorious thing. But it is within the context of marriage. So Paul gives his counsel on the matter. But then you get people who say, "Ah, yes, but Paul has said it is good for a man not to touch a woman." Well, yes, Paul comes on and deals with that. Verse 7, "I wish that all men were even as I myself," that is, single, full-time missionary. "But each one has his own gift from God, one in this matter and another in that." What does he mean by this? Well, he's actually referring to something that Jesus said. In Matthew chapter 19, Jesus is speaking about divorce. We'll read the whole section from verse 1 of Matthew 19. "It came to pass, when Jesus had finished these sayings, that he departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him, and saying to him, 'Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife, for just any reason?' And he answered and said to them, 'Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate.' They said to him, 'Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?' He said to them, 'Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery.' His disciples said to him, 'If such is the case of a man with his wife, it's better not to marry.' Good grief, lumbered with a woman for the whole of life, dear me. But Jesus said to them, 'All cannot accept this saying, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born thus from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He who is able to accept it, let him accept it.'" What Jesus is saying is that there are different kinds of people. Some people are by nature eunuchs. They are unable to marry. They have no desire to marry. There are others who have been taken by men and castrated and so cannot marry and have lost all passion and desire for women. But then he says there are those who have said to themselves, as Paul says, there are advantages in being single. There are advantages in not being bound to a wife. There are spiritual advantages for me and for the lost, in that I can go and preach to the lost without ever having to worry about a wife and having to look after her. So therefore I choose not to marry. That is, not that they are physically castrated, but they choose to suppress all thoughts of marriage. Jesus says it's not suitable for all, But it is a conscious decision that some people make. It's not that they scratch their heads and they pray and they say, God, is it your will that I don't marry? They choose. They decide. And they decide that for their own benefit and for the benefit of others, they will not marry. Now, it is said by some that ministers of the gospel, bishops, some people call them priests, although that is false, should not be married. In Romanism, for example, a priest, what is not a priest at all really, but they say that a priest should not marry. They teach celibacy, the unmarried state. I've no clue where they get it from, because we read about Peter's mother-in-law. In order to have a mother-in-law, you have to have a wife. So Peter was married. We also read this in 1 Timothy chapter 3. This is a faithful saying: if a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife. Now, there is a question as to whether Paul is saying a bishop must be married. But one thing is certain: a bishop may be married. And certainly this is a prohibition upon a bishop being a polygamist. The Bible nowhere explicitly condemns polygamy, but it says that the norm, the best, is one man and one woman. But if, perchance, you have three wives, and then you're converted, Paul's saying here, you can never be a bishop, you can never be an elder. You must only have one wife. And Paul goes on to say that it is observing the way in which a man rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. One of the indications as to whether this man is suitable for the work of a bishop. Once again, it's not a question of, is this God's man for the job? It's not a question of, has God called this man? It's not a question of, is this God's will that we call this man? Not a question of, does this man glow green in the pulpit? Not a question of, does the finger of God appear out of the ceiling pointing down saying, this is the one? You look, you evaluate, and you decide. Is this man suitable? I wonder how many men are ministers of churches because they just happened to glow green one morning in the pulpit. And the churches have regretted it ever since. How do we get rid of this man? He's awful. Well, surely you could have seen that before you called him. Now, in Roman Catholicism, we see that there is no basis at all for their teaching on celibacy. In fact, half of them don't believe it anyway. Half of them have what are euphemistically called housekeepers. Housekeeper is just a long way of saying wife, because they are virtually wives in very many cases. No, you see in Roman Catholicism, and all who teach, you must not marry if you're going to perform this function, what you see is immorality. It encourages immorality. That's exactly what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7. Indeed, he says later on that in verse 9, speaking to the unmarried, I say to you and to widows, it is good for them to, if they remain even as I am, single. But if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Because if you burn with passion, it will stir up temptations within you, and there is the great danger that you will commit immorality. And it is better than to commit immorality that you marry. But we find that there are these people around who encourage us that it is better to remain single and that you must remain single under certain circumstances. And we find that there are people who forbid marriage. Well, of course, it's not just Roman Catholicism. There are several different groups who insist upon this. But it's wrong. It is contrary to the teaching of the Scriptures. When you consider just what an immoral and godless society we live in, isn't it better that instead of all this godless immorality which infects the church, that people marry and that people are encouraged within marriage to give themselves to one another. Now, what about divorce? Well, there's a long section yet to come in 1 Corinthians 7, so we're not going to deal with that this morning. We're going to begin looking at that next week. Your questions about divorce: is it right ever to divorce? Is it right ever, if you are divorced, to remarry? We're going to look at these issues because they are all around us and they affect us. So we have to consider them and find out what the Bible itself has to say. But in closing, let us remind ourselves of these things that we've seen here and the implications of them. It is always better to marry than to sin. Always, in all circumstances. If you think that you cannot live without being immoral, then you should marry. Always assuming you can find someone who is prepared to put up with you. So should I marry? Well, if you can, don't. But if you can't, do. But make sure it's someone suitable. Paul deals with this later on in the chapter as to who you should marry. But one thing you can consider in the meantime is, if I do want to marry, not who am I going to marry, but am I a suitable person to marry? Am I godly? Am I the sort of person that someone else would want to marry? Then consider, who do you belong to? Who owns your body? If you're single, it's God's body. It belongs to Him. And how you use it is to be determined by Him. Our bodies are not little playgrounds for us to play around in, nor are they little playgrounds for other people to play around in. Our bodies are God's body, for God to use as God has decreed. If you're married, your body belongs to Christ, and also it belongs to your spouse, and it is to be used as they determine. There is this idea: my body, I can do what I like with it. No, you can't, because it's not your body. Your body belongs to God. It's God's body. Secondarily, to your spouse. But of course, this is what we hear time and again when the subject of abortion comes up. A woman says, it's my body, I'll do what I like with my body. No, you're wrong. It's not your body. God's body, your husband's body. But I don't want this child. Well, that's really a bit late. The act by which the child was conceived is one that you freely consented to, so therefore, you have to consider the consequences. And as it is better to marry than to burn with passion, it is better to have a child than to murder it. Because abortion is killing the life of another human being. And it should not be allowed except under reasons of the health of the woman. If the continued pregnancy can be shown to bring about the death of the woman, then you can justify it. But if it's just that she doesn't want it, well, I'm sorry, you should have thought of that before you partook of the act that brought about the pregnancy. But on the day of judgment, God is not going to say to us, well, were you married or were you not? Did you have children or didn't you? He's not going to ask us those sort of things. What God's going to ask us is, were you ever married to Jesus Christ? Were you ever betrothed to Him in love? Did you ever receive Him into your heart? Did you ever take Him as your own? Did you ever take Him as the number one in your life? For Him to graciously lead you through life. This is what God is concerned about. It's not your marital status. God is concerned about your spiritual status. Are you united in bonds of love to Christ? And that's what we need to ask ourselves. Am I Christ's? Do I belong to Him? And if I say, yes, I do belong to Him, then how should I live to please Him? And so we see that these principles that Paul lays out here, though they might be explicitly apparently only for those who are married, there is teaching here that is relevant to all of us, and most especially relating to our relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ, and it concerns our eternal well-being. So let's not push all this out of our minds, but let's consider what God has said, and let's seek to put it into practice in our own lives as is appropriate, that we might live to his praise and to his glory.